Good afternoon. My name is Candace Moore. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you guys for allowing me to come and participate, hang out with you this weekend. I'm excited. Now that I am awake, I'm excited. I was here yesterday on 2 hours sleep, and my hair looked bad. It just didn't look recovered. And so, and I apologize because you sounded great, but I kept nodding off, and my head would jerk up, and I thought, they're going to punch me. So I just wanted to let you know that I heard most of your talk, and I'm going to listen to the rest later. I want to thank the committee, especially. They invited me 2 years ago for this conference, and, just how exciting it takes so much work to put this deal on. These are not easy. All the things that go into making sure that you all are comfortable and that your weekend is filled with some type of recovery, especially for those who are new, so that you are excited and inspired to join us on this deal. It's not easy to put this on, and I really want to acknowledge the committee. For sure. What a great place this is. I was just chatting with housekeeping, the lady who was taking care of the room for me right before I got dressed. Now, I did my hair right before she came in, but she saw me yesterday when I came. And so she walked in, and the first thing she said is, "Oh, it grew." I said, "Yeah." You too can work this out. And that's all for you in Macon, Georgia. So if you're new, I just want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to share with you what I have found, and that's you've been given the keys of the kingdom. You've been given the keys of the kingdom. I also want to share with you something that you should know now so that we don't spring it on you later, and that this is a program of action. It's not a program of whether or not I feel like it. There are a lot of things that she's like, yeah! There are a lot of things I don't feel like doing, but at the end of the day, I don't feel like dying drunk. I can assure you that if I, right now, stop doing what you've taught me to do and I walk back out there, I'm not going to die in a pretty hotel like the Marriott. I'm not that type of an alcoholic. I'm going to die in a seedy place having done seedy things with seedy people. I don't ever want to forget what it took for me to come to you surrendered. If you are new, welcome. Welcome to a new way of life. We're not looking at you for who you are right now and all the craziness that you're bringing to us. We're looking at you for who we know you will become if you stay with us and you apply these principles and these traditions in your life. That's what's happening here. You know, I want to share with you three things. They are three of the most important things in my entire life. My sobriety date is August 16th, 1995. It is the most important date in my life. 14 years of continuous sobriety for an alcoholic of my type is an eternity. It's forever. It's more than I thought that I was ever going to have. I didn't come to you looking for anything continuous. I came to you pooped. I was worn out. I'm busy when I'm out there. You know, the condition in which I was brought to you is I was 96 pounds because when I drink, I tend to stay up 8 and 9 days straight. I do things that keep me up. And so a nutritious meal for me would be like a Snickers bar every 3 or 4 days to keep my energy level up, you know? And when I came to you, I was missing my front tooth because I'm a mouthy little alcoholic. And apparently someone begged to differ with something I had to share. When I came to you, I didn't have a strand of hair on my head because when I start drinking, I tend to incorporate some things that, for lack of a better term, tend to produce a tweaking sensation. And so I used to think things were running around up there. And I remember I was getting drunk with one of my buddies. And just never take advice from your drunk friend, just FYI. You know, but I was getting drunk with one of my buddies, and I told her, I said, "Hey, something's up there." And she said, "Really? How do you know?" And I said, "Because they just ran from this side to that side." And she didn't tell me that this was a direction that I need to take. She more or less just threw it out there, and I embraced it. She said, "You know, rubbing alcohol sterilizes anything." Well, the next time I was getting loaded, which was like a few hours later, I had a bottle of rubbing alcohol, and you know, I was doing my thing and they were doing their thing. It was like some radical movement going on. And so what I did is I sat him down and I talked to him. I said, look, I know you're up there. I know you're up there and you can stay. I'm not trying to evict anyone, okay? You can stay up there, but we need to calm it down. And so, you know, so I told him what I'm going to do is I'm going to sterilize you. And so I would take the rubbing alcohol and I would pour it all over my head, and it was soothing, really. And then after a while, they became immune to it, much like a roach will eventually become immune to rage. Now, I don't have roaches at this time in my life, okay? But in the past, we have had relations. And so, you know, if you've ever, now maybe you're not the type of alcoholic that I was, okay? Now, if you've ever had roaches, you know that in the beginning, they see Raid, they cower, they tell their friends, don't go, she has Raid, you know what I mean? But then as the time goes on, they get very arrogant. Yeah, so then you see the same roach, he's got a little helmet on, he's got a little artillery, you know what I mean? And you're spraying him, he's like, ah, ah, you know, he's like back at you. So this is what was going on with whatever was in my head. They just became immune to the rubbing alcohol. And so what I did is I took far drastic measures. I took a pair of scissors, I cut off all my hair, and then to be thorough, I took a shaver and I shaved it all to the scalp. There would be no hanging on these follicles. You know what I mean? And that's the condition in which I was brought to you. It was clear that whatever was going on in my life wasn't working. When I came to you, all illusions, all delusions, and all facades have been stripped from me. The reason I continue to stay in the center of you is through application of all 12 steps, and equally as important, all 12 traditions, all illusions, all delusions, and all facades are continually stripped from me. If I am to be here with you, I have to get right-sized. I suffer from a disease that wants me dead. It wants me alone in a room with a gun in one hand and a drink in the other. But it will never take me away from you when I am in love with you. It has to go about setting up a series of circumstances and events that make it look as if my case is different, that make it look as if I've made too big a deal out of this to begin with, that make it look as if you don't have my back. That's why I have to have the second thing in place, a sponsor. My sponsor is Clancy. He is sober a lot longer than I am. He is a lot more active than I am, and I am incredibly active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I only speak active sobriety. I've never not been active. It has held me in good stead through many a storm here. When I came to Clancy, I came to him at 9 years sober. I had always had strong sponsorship. My former sponsor, Gloria Decker, was the love of my life. You know, and what ended up happening is I came to him on the heels of a breakup. It was a horrible relationship, a hideous, 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 sick, 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 horrible, horrible, bad relationship. But I'm committed, and when I'm committed, everybody's committed. You know what I mean? And so the way I look at it is, you know, it was bad. Yeah, it was verbally and physically abusive. I participated equally in both. And my sponsor would talk to me. My sponsor was Gloria, and she would say, Candace, you have to leave this relationship. Candace, you are living drunk. I'm talking sober, but I'm living drunk. And I would say, no, I can't leave because this is my soulmate. So convinced that my sponsor was not really plugged in, even though prior to, she had always given me solid direction. But on this one, she was a little foggy, you know. So I had to go to God himself. And I went to God. God, give me a sign. Should I stay in the relationship? The police would come. Oh, no, not that sign. Right? And so, you know, what do you do after, you know, it just seems like it's gone in the toilet. It's just gone down the drain. Well, I'll tell you what we did. We got engaged. And we were engaged for 6 days, but they were long days. And at the end of that, it was game over, and I was in so much pain, I can't tell you. I was in so much pain after that breakup that it hurt to breathe. I had never felt that type of pain because I had never been in love before, and I've been in relationships, I've had proposals, all of that. But I had never been present. I had never cared. And it just, everything in me hurt. I was angry at God. I had lost all the women I sponsored. I sponsored a lot of girls. But it got to the point where I started saying I don't want to be here anymore, that I wanted to drink. and they didn't feel safe with me. I would be in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer wearing long sleeves because I had bruises. And I would be talking about living a new way of life. And I knew that when I left, and my partner would sit up in the front and I would smile adoringly for a couple of reasons. One, so that you felt we were a happy couple. Two, so that you knew they were taken with bruises on. And I would leave and we would go back to the same thing. And the women that I had sponsored, you know, understand that at this point, I was 8 years sober when all the things just started going haywire. And we split. And I'll tell you something. These women I had sponsored for 7 years at that point, most of them. I had been in their weddings. I had hosted baby showers, bridal showers, housewarming parties. We were a family. And I lost my family. And I was devastated. And I didn't know what to do. My sponsor, my former sponsor, Gloria, was very sick at the time. And I just felt like the rug had been pulled out from underneath me. 6 days later, I was in another relationship. And it was verbally and it was physically abusive, and the police were back at my house. When I got into that second relationship, they were already in a relationship. But here's what untreated alcoholism looks like in my life. When I'm in pain, this individual had pursued me for the year that I was in my relationship, and I would say, no, I'm not a cheater. But now that I'm out of my relationship, the fact that you're still in one is a technicality. My former partner is not in Alcoholics Anonymous. This person was. I went to a meeting where I knew they were. I held up my left hand, signaling the absence of my ring finger. And I gave that come hither look. And we hooked up and we did our deal. So I know what it's like to have my name smeared in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and a lot of it was true. And I remember telling this person, I said, you have to get out of that relationship because I don't want anyone thinking that I'm with someone who's already in a relationship because I'm in AA. You know, I used to think it was a compliment when someone who's in a relationship would flirt with me when their partner would leave the room. I thought it was because I was so cute. What the deal is that when you have low self-esteem, that type of behavior is a compliment. What I didn't understand is that they are disrespecting me, they are disrespecting their partner, and they obviously don't have any integrity to bring to the table to begin with. But I don't know that when I don't understand my worth. So this situation that I'm talking about brought me to my knees. It culminated to this point. My then partner and I, the second one, we were lying in bed and I was in pain. I was suffering from spiritual decay. And I looked over and I said, if I drank, would you leave? They said, no. I said, if I drink, will you drink with me? And they said, yes. Because their love for me was like my love for my ex. And, you know, different people have different reactions when I share that. Oh, my God, I can't believe you would ask another member to drink. And I just look at them, you know what I mean? And I'm like, sugar, then maybe you don't suffer from the disease that I suffer from. I suffer from alcoholism. Alcoholism is not a disease for the pretty. Alcoholism is a disfiguring, distorting, and debilitating disease. When I am in pain, when I am in spiritual deprivation, I am not drinking alone. You should be clear. And the reality is that there was no alcohol in the house. That's why my sobriety date has never changed. I don't take anything that affects me from the neck up. I don't drink near beer because I'm not near sober. You know, Bill's story, I love Bill's story. I love Bill's story because Bill was just wackadoo. You know what I mean? I'm so grateful he didn't do crack because he was already gone. You know, when you read Bill's story, and I hear people say crazy things like, if you want to go to sleep, read the big book. I'm like, what book are you reading? The book that I read is exciting. It's a bestseller. That book is just like mind-blowing. You know, I'm reading Bill's story, and Bill just sucks you in. You know, he says for 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. You're like, go, Bill, go, right? And then he says, but then that frightful day came when I drank once more. You're like, no, Bill, no, right? Because you're hanging in there. His journey is your journey. You're like, we were doing so good, Bill. We were doing so good, you know. And then there's that point where he's talking about his friend. His friend comes over. They used to get their drunk on. Bill's excited. And because Bill believes in singleness of purpose, he tells you, he sets the bottle right on the table. You don't have to come in and do pleasantries. How you doing? Who cares? You know what I mean? You got a glass, here you go. You know. But he says his friend was sober. Ooh, blick. Right? Unmindful of his welfare, he was going to drink openly with him. That's the deal. Because what Bill is thinking is that even though Bill is hitting bottom and, you know, people are leaving, friends don't want to talk to him, he still has his bottle. His friend comes over. Even though this man is sober, Bill is saying, if I drink long enough, you're going to want what I have. That's untreated alcoholism. If I am not applying these principles and traditions in my life on a daily basis, that's what starts happening. One more time, I become a walking liability. So by the time I got to Clancy, I was just in so much pain. I wanted to drink for a year at that point. And I was just out of answers. And if you are here and you are new, or you are here and you've been here for a while, but you're thinking about leaving, I hope you are out of answers. You know, when I came to him at 9 years sober, previously I had known everything. I'm very active and I participate in various areas of service. And anytime you talk to me, I would just say, I know. And sometimes I would let you talk for a little bit, but I couldn't take it because I knew. And I would say, I know. You know what I mean? People get annoyed when you do that. When I came to him, I didn't know anything anymore. And it was the best thing that could have happened to me. I am so grateful that he has cared more about my life than my feelings. What he did is he gave me concrete direction based on the information in our book. It allowed me to restore some integrity into my sobriety. What I had to do during this period, because it was torturous, it was hard, and it was just like living in dark for almost 2 years, because I wanted to drink total for almost 2 years, I had to change my conduct. And it was the hardest thing for me. I had to get still by myself. I had to learn to sit by myself and get clear on my worth. What I didn't understand when I went through this period, and what I got to see as I started doing the work with Clancy, is that I had no idea of my value. I was holding on to old ideas in the area of relationships, and I didn't know it. I had no idea that although I had some recovery over here, when it came to this, I still felt damaged. You know, it talks about it in step 4. It says the purpose of an inventory is to disclose and get rid of damaged and unsaleable goods. That's what I still felt, and I didn't know it. I had no idea. And so what I had to do is I had to redefine, and I'm so grateful for the steps. You know, when I went back through the steps and did that sex inventory, and I got a new ideal. And I remember, because I was by myself for almost 2 years, anyone that would ask me out, I would just say, no, thank you. I would shake hands. It's like, I don't need to, you hugging all on me, get away. You know what I mean? And I remember listing my ideals, and let's say I had 5 ideals. I wouldn't date until I was all of those ideals. Because I come from a place of, I want you to have X, Y, Z, but I'm only bringing 1% to the table and you should be happy about it. So at this point, now I want to do something differently. So if I had 2 out of 5, I couldn't date. When I had 4 out of 5, I couldn't date. When I had 5 out of 5, I was ready to date. And even then, I had to conduct myself differently. I didn't understand that what I was giving you was a gift. It's not something to get you to lock you in and to hook you. It's a gift. What I'm sharing with you, and until I was able to view it that way, I was going to get the same result. I came so close to drinking, I can't share with you enough. I just don't live that way anymore. And if you are struggling with that, you know, please get into the book. There are some things that we can do here. You know, my home group is the Pacific group. It is a very active group, and I have to be around people that are excited about sobriety, because sometimes it's hard to stay here. Life on life's terms can just, it can break you down. You know, and I need to be around people that are like-minded, that are on this path. You know, I want to share something with you. When I was newly sober, I went through a recovery home, and it has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous because we are not affiliated. But what that recovery home did for me is it gave me the opportunity to sit still and get safe, because the way I live, you know, I couldn't do outpatient because I would have just been out. You know what I mean? And so in this recovery home, I was 50 or 60 days sober, and they were reading from Tradition 3. Now, my sponsor at the time wanted to wait until I got out of their facility to take me formally through the steps. So although I hadn't yet gotten into the work, I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved that I was waking up in a clean bed. I was brushing the teeth I had left. You know what I mean? I was bathing. It was like fun, stuff like that. Like, ooh. And so we were reading from Tradition 3, and I remember this fear started gripping my heart, and so I'm going to share it with you. This is on page 140 in the 12 and 12, and it's talking about when Alcoholics Anonymous was very new. It says, we were resolved to admit nobody to AA, but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they could have no other complications. So beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, playing crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Huh. It says, yes, sir, we cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Huh. Now, I don't know about you, but chances are, if I'm pure and respectable, I ain't alcoholic. And then they so boldly list, okay, what are we working with here? Beggar, trans, asylum, and prayer, queer. I'm 4 out of 5 right there. So if all these things were still in place, I would never have had an opportunity to come and take my seat amongst you. But if you hang in there with me and we go to the top of page 141, it says, could we then foresee that troublesome people were to become our principal teachers of patience and tolerance? Could we then imagine any society which would include every conceivable kind of character and cut across every barrier of race, creed, politics, and language with ease? Now they're just talking about the Alcoholics Anonymous, I know. They're just talking about the language of the heart. It doesn't matter where you work. It doesn't matter what your family has done. It doesn't matter what your sexual preference is, if you've even figured it out. First 2 years are a little sketchy. You know what I mean? None of that matters. If you have a desire to stop drinking, there is some information and directions outlined in our book that will help you. That's the deal. You know, so when I was little, my grandmother raised me, and she just loved me. Oh, I know what it's like to be loved and made to feel so safe, so secure, so protected that absolutely nothing could ever harm me. I know what it's like to have that type of love because I've had it. I remember when I was little, I was afraid of the dark, and at night I would sleep next to my grandmother, and as she slept, I would watch her breathe. She would inhale, I would inhale. She would exhale, I would exhale. Because if she died, I wanted to die with her. That's the depth of love I had for my grandmother. My mom is an alcoholic. She is an alcoholic by her own admission. She was very young when she had me. She wasn't done doing what she needed to do. I didn't understand it then, but I understand it today. My mother is very well endowed, and she believes in packing her pistol in her bosom because she's quirky like that. And the way she would communicate her needs and wants, if she would call my grandmother up on the phone, I always knew who it was because my grandmother would start gripping the receiver real tight and that little vein would pop out right in the center of her forehead. My mother would make some incessant demand. My grandmother would look at the phone and go, what? Absolutely not. There we go, the phone. A short while later, my mom would pop over and just shoot out all the windows. Now, let us be clear. I didn't want what she had. There are other cousins and uncles in my family who also suffer from this disease, but it is not why I'm an alcoholic. The Big Book explains to me that when I, not them, ingest alcohol into my system, it's going to set up a phenomenon of craving that will ensure I'm going to do any and everything I have to do in order to get another drink. The way this disease manifests in my family happens to be through a lot of violence. A lot of the members favored shooting. I favored stabbing. Tomato, tomato. You know what I mean? So it's safe to say that when we all get together at some point, the police are going to be present. Now, I'm just going to give you like a holiday at my mom's house. My mother is a big girl. She cooks from scratch. I don't, nor am I inspired to when the directions are so clearly outlined on the box. So when I cook, if it says to measure 1/4 cup, I must measure precisely 1/4 cup. Because if I go a hair over, I will pour it all out and I will begin again. That's not how my mom cooks. Oh, no. My mother is like a smidgen of this, a dab of that. A fabulous creation is going to be had. So if she's cooking, I got to go. It's almost like going to any length. You know what I mean? Now, understand, you will get a meal at my mother's house. It just may come with a little something extra. So when I go over her house, it's early afternoon. She's already getting her drunk on. That's a given. But the deal is, you go by the music that's playing. So I would go over, it's early afternoon, but the music would be upbeat. She would be listening to the Spinners and the Whispers. It's okay. We're good. And then as the day goes on, you can smell the aroma wafting throughout the house. And at this point, she's listening to Diana Ross. We're okay. We're okay. As we enter into early dusk, we get into the Sam Cooke juncture. Uh-oh. Okay, because at Sam Cooke, you want to get the plate and the foil. You want to lay them side by side. Like a sprinter, you want to start getting limber. You start getting loose. You know what I mean? By the time nightfall hits, Billie Holiday. Run. By the time my mom got to Billie Holiday, she had been drinking. Now she's thinking. And in a minute, she's going to start crying, you know, thinking about what's gone wrong. And then she's going to get pissed off and want to fight. So you understand that you will get a meal. You may limp out with it, but you'll get a meal at my mom's house. I look back over it. It's not a good or bad thing. It's just the way it was at my mom's house. You know, I got into junior high. My friends were drinking and having a good time. I wanted to have a good time, too. Very simple in the beginning. But here's what happens for me when I take a drink of alcohol. When I take a drink of alcohol, I cease to care about you. Ugh, I'm lying. I don't care about you before I take a drink of alcohol. But now that I've taken the drink, I want to share with you that I don't care about you. So, you know, please resist the urge to pull me to the side and tell me how I have wronged you and how I have imposed my... Who asked you? Who cares? You know, my friends would come to me in tear-stained faces and angst over what I had done the night before, and they would want to tell me each and every inflection of the voice and twist of the head, and I'm just looking at them, you know, and they would go on and on. The funny thing is, we get over things much faster than our friends. You know what I mean? 4 days later, they're still pissed off. You're like, girl, are you still pissed about that? You know, you need to turn it over. Anyway, so they would, because I'm moving on. You know, so they would go on, and then they would pause for effect, right? And so I would pause too, right? And I would think, ooh, they're looking for something here. They need some type of something, you know? And so I would say, well, that's unfortunate. You know what I mean? I didn't know what type of nurturing they were seeking, but I can assure you I was incapable and uninterested in providing it. It talks about me in the book. It says that I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate seemingly without provocation. Not only do I step on your toes, but I'm wearing the highest of heels at all times when I'm doing it. Without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a column 1-2 type of gal. I live in the who you are and what you did to piss me off. It's not until I come into this program broken and devastated from this disease that I'm willing to move into columns 3 and 4. What is this affecting? How is this affecting my self-esteem, my personal relations, my pocketbook, my ambition, my security? Column 4, where have I been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened? Because what it says is, did I not myself set the ball rolling? I have to get down to causes and conditions. So at this point, I'm doing my deal. I'm drinking, you know, and I remember I was living with my godmother, and she had purchased her Mercedes. She had this car for about 6 months. She was leaving to attend a Black Caucus conference in Washington. She would be gone for 1 week. She did what any adult would do. She took her vehicle, parked it in her driveway, took her keys, and placed them in the candy dish in her home. The only thing missing from that equation was me. And as luck would have it, I was going to this club later on that night. Now, I vaguely, it's foggy, remember her saying something like, don't touch my car. I don't know. You know what I mean? And so she's gone. She's on the plane. I'm there. The car is whispering to me at this point, you know. And so I'm obviously going to take it out for a spin. So that whole day was spent with Candace and Self. How Self would be featured. What Self would debut. How Self would be presented, you know. And as I'm driving the car consumed with Self, I ran into someone else's car. Whoops. Okay, so my hat's off to the person that has a valid driver's license and insurance, because it wasn't happening for me. I made like I was going to do the appropriate thing, pull over and exchange information, but it wasn't my car. I didn't have any information to exchange. And I had a sneaking suspicion she was going to want to arrest me. The cops. Clearly that wasn't going to work because I was going to the club later on that night. So now the whole front end of the car has a permanent grin. And I take it, I drive it back into the driveway, I take the keys, I place them back into the candy dish, I go upstairs, I call my friend, and I tell her, we're taking a cab. I also had an inkling of a notion that my godmother was going to be none too pleased about this car situation, and she was in fact quite peeved. She had seen the movie Tough Love. I have never seen this movie. I don't desire to see this movie. But the effect it had on her was profound, I can assure you. After having seen this movie, she now was inspired and she drew up a contract of things I was expected to do for having wrecked her car. And I remember as I looked at her in horror as she read off what sounded like 1,000 things. Now, in reality, it may have only been 2, but when you're in self, 1 is too many. And so she was just reading all these things. She wanted me to do things like volunteer my time and give of myself to some charitable organization. I thought, ooh, what an order. I can't go through with it. You know, and she was just so agitated. Her little neck veins kept bulging out, you know. And I remember she was talking to me. I had this one thought repeatedly playing in my head. And that thought was, you have insurance. Why are you tripping? That's untreated alcoholism. Alcoholism will never allow me to step into any type of accountability. Alcoholism will never allow me to take an honest look at my part, let alone acknowledge it. Alcoholism will tell me that you need to turn this over. You need to let it go. Because what's going on in my head is I didn't mean to do it. You know, like, I feel that should be sufficient, really. You know, like, I think we should just put it behind us and move on, you know. But the reality is I've damaged her personal property. I've disrespected her home. I have violated her trust. These things don't even occur to me. And that is the authentic place that I emanate from without any principles in my life. Even today, if I stop doing the work, that is who I become. And so what ends up happening is she just basically held a grudge and the atmosphere remained tense, so I moved out. And, you know, the following year I was working in Beverly Hills. I met a couple of people. One of them gave me an opportunity to work for a record label. When they hired me at this label, they hired me as a receptionist. But I'd like to think of myself more of a visionary. Some say delusional. I say visionary. So, yes, technically, they hired me as a receptionist, but really, I felt they were grooming me for CEO. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I always waited for the tap, you know, that even though you've barely had a regular job and you know nothing, please run the company. I waited for that to happen, you know. And so what ends up happening is I got promoted. I worked in promotion for a long time, and I worked with incredibly successful multi-platinum artists, and it was great, and it was grand, and we were all cute. But here's the thing. The more I got promoted, the more I got loaded. There is an old-timer whom I just love and respect. She always says that alcohol gave me the wings to fly, and then it took away the sky. Alcohol allowed all my dreams to come true. I'm not here because I never lived my dreams. I'm here because alcohol dictated everything I did in my life. It told me when I would do it, the duration of which it would last, how it would look, and when I would resume doing it. If you would have encountered me during that period in my life, you would have thought I was absolutely the most self-assured, confident individual you would ever come across. But I can assure you that every day I felt like a little kid playing dress up. Every day I felt as if you were going to find out that my mother lived in a poor area, was an abusive parent, and that you were going to look at me and you were going to say, you're not one of us, you don't belong here, get out. That's alcoholism. Alcoholism centers in fear, lack, limitation. You're not going to make the grade. You're not going to measure up. The rug's going to be pulled out from underneath you at any moment. I'm so grateful to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that have come here, that have taken all 12 steps. Because in my opinion, you are a newcomer until you take all 12 steps. So if you want to sit here and drag it out for 8 years, that's your business. But I'm so grateful to those members that did all 12 steps that showed me how to take contrary action. I have a head that tells me I'm not worth it, I can't do this, I'm never gonna. You know, when I got sober, They labeled me a lot of stuff. Boy, they will label you. Are you doing your nails? She's like totally doing her nails. She's like, uh-huh. And so, you know, you are just so cute. Hey. So, you know, they told me that I was a lot of things, bipolar, something, something, post-traumatic stress disorder. It was a lot. You know what I mean? Like, that was a lot. And I was like, wow, I'm all of that? Really? You know what I mean? I'm already depressed. You know what I mean? I'm bald-headed with no tooth, and now you're telling me all this. You know, wow, what are we going to do with this information? You know, because I would get depressed, and of course I'm going to get depressed. I'm homeless, and I'm bald-headed as an adult woman. Wouldn't you be depressed? You know what I mean? And so, you know, fortunately, they prescribed stuff that I've never taken. But what I found is that I had to train my feet here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know that that's everyone's experience. I'm not your doctor, and it's not my business. I can only share with you my deal. They always try to sell me short on everything. I know how to be loaded. I know how to take pills, but I don't know how to be sober. And at this period in my life, you know, when I was in that business, I was medicated all the time on something to make me wake up, to get me to sleep. And so if you would have encountered me, even though it looked like I may have had it together, I was just oozing fear all the time, insecurity all the time, unsure of who I was all the time, trying to fit into whatever image, you know, whatever artist I was promoting all the time. And here's what happened. What happened is that my grandmother died. My grandmother died, and it changed my entire life. When I found out she had died, I found out after she had already been buried. This woman gave everything for me. She dealt with my mother, the craziness, people trying to kidnap me to make my mother pay her debts, all of this. My grandmother was always there for me. You know, you have that one person in your corner? She was it. She doesn't matter what people said about me. She was in my corner, and I couldn't even show up to her funeral. That's the type of woman I am without Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was little, my grandmother would bring home a lemon meringue pie from Marie Callender's every week. She brought it home because it was my favorite pie. Every week. And I was like 11 years old. She had all these old cookbooks, and I asked her if I could make a pie. And she goes, yeah, we're going to go to the store. We're going to get all the ingredients, and you can make the pie. I'm like, okay. So we go to the store, and I have written everything out. I'm very anal on my list and in order of importance. And so, you know, we get all this. Oh, I just bit my tongue. Oh, Lord. Okay, so we get all this stuff. I was all in the zone, too. I was like, oh, my God. You know what I mean? Ah, man, there's some water. Edit that from the tape. So anyway, so we get all this stuff, and then that night she's going to bed, and so she asks, she goes, are you going to make the pie later on? I'm like, I'm going to make the pie. So I'm in the kitchen all by myself. I'm 11, but I'm excited, right? I got a little project. I got all this stuff. The only thing I didn't have was a mixer, and who knew I needed one? So I go through the whole deal, and I make the meringue. Wait, no, I make the filling, and it looks beautiful. I mean, I'm just so excited. And then I get to the meringue, the fluffy part, which is supposed to be the easiest part, right? So it had like 3 egg whites, maybe some sugar, something like that. So I put it in the bowl, and I have my fork, and I'm whipping, right? And I'm waiting for it to get fluffy, but it's not getting fluffy. And I'm whipping, but it's not getting fluffy. So I'm getting frustrated because I'm 11, right? And so I'm whipping. It's not getting, so it's like 10 minutes, and I'm whipping. It's not getting, matter of fact, it's getting more like syrupy. So I get concerned. I put a little more sugar in there, and I'm whipping, but it's not getting fluffy. So I put a little cornstarch in there, thicken it right up. You know what I mean? And I'm whipping, but it's not getting fluffy. Okay. So I put a little vanilla extract, because it's vanilla. And then just for good measure, I put some ice cream in it, right? And so now I'm done. It doesn't quite look like the pies that she's brought home, but at this point, I'm traumatized, and I really just want to put it behind me. So I'm done with it. The next day, my grandmother and I are hanging out in the kitchen, and at some point, she realizes I was supposed to have made the pie. And so she asked me, she said, did you make the pie? And I go, oh, the trauma comes back. I'm like, oh, yes, but it didn't come out good, right? And now the funny thing is, she had gone in the refrigerator like 5 times so far, but she just didn't recognize it. So she said, well, give me a slice. And I said, no, I love my grandmother. I'm not going to give her a slice of this pie. I'm not even going to eat this pie. And she said, no, I'm sure it's okay. Give me a slice. So I thought she was going to do the grandmother thing, take a bite, and say, don't worry, it'll be better next time. What she did is she ate the entire slice. And then she said, it'll be better next time. You know what I mean? But the deal is, for me, that's unconditional love. I have only been loved like that twice, with her and when I came to you. It's a type of love that fills every space in you up. It's a type of love that you don't have to explain. You don't have to wonder if it's really, you already know. It's in your gut, that type of love. And when I found out that she had passed, I didn't have any emotion connected to that moment. I look back over my drinking history. I didn't have any emotion connected to a lot of things because I was never present. I was always drunk or preoccupied with getting drunk or how you were going to get me drunk, so that I was never aware of what was really going on. And when I started to get what had happened, I'm not sure if it was a week to a month after she had passed, but I remember being at home and looking at my stuff no longer being enough. And that was frightening, because at that time in my life, it was very important, the label I worked for, the artist I represented, where I lived, the title I held, who I knew, all of those things were super, super important for me. My friendships were not based on shared goals and common ambition. They were based on, you're cute, I'm cute, we need to hang out. No depth and weight needed, don't even bring it up. I had been raised in a world of smoke and mirrors, a world of talk so fast and dazzle them, they don't see what's really going on. It is not until I came to you broken and devastated that I found it is an inside job. My dear friend Lynette always says, if you don't go within, you will go without. And that has been my experience. So I'm looking at my stuff, it's not enough, and my head starts talking to me. It was always chatting. I call them the voices of little Damien kids. You know what I mean? It's always, it never tells me, oh my God, you can do this, you'll be victorious. It says, are you going to die any minute? I'm like, oh my God, who are you talking to? So anyway, my head's telling me this crazy stuff, and it tells me that I need to get real, but I don't know how to get real. I just know how to get loaded. And in the doctor's opinion, it talks about why we drink. And Camille was talking about it last night. I was like, oh, I love when someone talks. It's my favorite part. You know, and I'm going to share it with you because of how it resonates in my spirit. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That although they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. The reason I remember this is because every time I took a drink, the sensation was so superb, so magnificent, bar none, even though every time I took a drink, I knew it was going to cause me chaos, confusion, insanity, jail, always a bonus. Even though every time I took a drink, I knew all this stuff was going to happen. When alcohol is working in my life, the sensation is unparalleled. I will go for broke in order to get it. And it tells me that I don't know what's real from what's not. Why? Because I'm making decisions based on self. My alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. That means something that was inconceivable, unacceptable just a week or so ago is now all in a day's drink. It's now par for the course. That's the reality. So what happened for me is I resigned from that industry. I had always been used to having a label take care of everything. Now I'm on my own. I have a very expensive habit, and I am not a periodic. I drink, period. So I stepped out there, and I marketed myself in exchange for a drink. I did everything I needed to do in order to get what I had to have. And if I stop doing what you've taught me to do here, I am under no illusion that I will walk right back out there and do it all over again. I believe once you've done something, it's not a big deal to do it again because the shock value has worn off. My head will tell me that if I do it like this and flip it like that, this time it'll be different. We can work it out. That's the delusion that I suffer from. So I'm out there, and I've already told you I drink and I do other things that keep me up for 8 and 9 days at a time, and I know that I'm a pure hope-to-die alcoholic. And so I'm doing all this stuff. I get pregnant. Now, I would never do anything to jeopardize the life of an unborn child. I simply would never, ever do it. And I know that there are stories of women who come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they talk about abstaining from drinking or doing anything else for the entire time that they were pregnant. That is not my experience. When I found out I was pregnant, because of how I was living, I made the decision to terminate that pregnancy. I'm not going to give you my opinion if I am pro or con, because it is an outside issue in Alcoholics Anonymous. But let me share this with you. I have been in meetings, and I have heard not only women but men share that when they were little, they were left with people they never, ever should have been left with because mommy was drunk or mommy had to drink. There is nothing worse than a drunk woman, the desperation of a drunk woman. The only thing that supersedes that is the desperation of a sober woman that sits in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, latching on to everyone just to find her identity. It takes so many people out. And at this time, I am living this life. I can't say that if I have this child, that she's always going to, or he's always going to be protected, because I don't do background checks on the people I hang out with when I'm getting loaded. So I made the decision to terminate that pregnancy, and at that time I learned via every news station, every radio station, every TV station that a member of my family was arrested for murdering and dismembering my 8-year-old cousin. The person responsible was my mother. You know, there just comes a time for everyone when your life is going to stop and it is going to stand still, and that time came for me. Because when this happened, the only thought that went through my head is that the way I was living right then would be the way I would live forevermore. I remember clearly as you can be when you stay loaded like I do, thinking that anything of value, anything of worth, anything of beauty is no longer afforded to me. Forget about it. Let it go. I had always believed that once your destiny had been determined, nothing could ever be done to change it. It is not until I came to you, broken and devastated, that I have found if you want what we have and you're willing to take the actions outlined in our book, your whole life can be reshaped. That's why I show up for Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the deal. I don't know what the doctors were talking about and what society was talking about and, oh, you have a record and, oh, and you'll never enough. That's not what AA told me. Alcoholics Anonymous met me where I was, put their hand out, and elevated me. That's been my experience here. When I went through all that behavior, walking around and just hooking up with this person, hooking up with that person, the way I got over a relationship is to get in another relationship. All those things are self-loathing for me. And I had no idea that it's just living drunk without a drink. When I sat still and redefined my belief system, when I truly went back through these steps, step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. It was clear that I was powerless. I wasn't even trying to have any power. I was just trying to get drunk. And the unmanageability produced by that, produced by my alcoholism, it says that lack of power is my dilemma. But the pain, you know, I have a friend, Carolyn, she always says you have to die in step one. I'm like, you are so dramatic. But the reality is you have to die in step one. Because if you don't die in step one, the old self, you can't run into the beauty, the glory, and the warmth of step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. In step two was when I start looking at what I need from a power greater than myself. I first have to acknowledge in step one that I am not the Alpha and the Omega. Because you need to understand, when I'm drinking, I am. I am a team player, my team. So in step two, I start looking at what are the characteristics I need in a God of my understanding. What do I want that relationship to look like? It's so easy for me to say, oh, when I get a partner, I want them to do X, Y, Z, and I'm going to do this so we can have that. But where do I stand when it comes to a God of my understanding? That's the relationship I need to put the time into. Because at 2 or 3 in the morning, I can be laying next to whomever, the finest of whatever, and it's not going to make me not want to drink. Step two is beautiful. It's just glorious. And in step three, it just gets better. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood God, my thinking and my actions over to a God. I'm not going to do that unless I've started getting to know this God in step two. So you think in step three, I'm just going to turn it over to what? I haven't taken any time. Turn it over to what does that look like? What it looks like for me is I do what you do. That is what step three is. It is an action step. I can't think my way into respect. I have to change my conduct. You go to meetings, I go to meetings. You get a job, I get a job. You get a sponsor, I get a sponsor. Step three. Keep it simple. So they get all, I'm going to break it down word by word. Girl, I don't have that type of time. Please. You know what I mean? And then in step three, it says we were reborn. Oh, thank you. I need that. You're telling me that you're going to wipe my slate clean? I don't think it gets better than that. Because I come to you with a lot of stuff, a lot of shame, a lot of secrets, a lot. There's just things I don't think can be made right. We're not even talking about my mother's sickness. We're talking about my stuff that I've done on those streets. And it says, right before we take the third step prayer, we were reborn. That's beautiful. And then I get on my knees and I say the third step prayer, or my version of the third step prayer, because I have a relationship with it now. And then it says we launch into a course of vigorous action. You know, I hear so many things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think some of them are very dangerous. You know, well, I've been on my fourth step for 8 months. Are you kidding me? You're sitting in sickness for 8 months? You think we're going to hang out? That's not going to happen. That's crazy. Why would you sit in that type of pain and filth? That's like my cat. I have two cats. I love them. A little shout out to my cats. But let me tell you something. One of my younger cats, when I vacuum, runs to her litter box and will sit in there. And I'm like, you cannot get on the bed if you run into that litter box. I mean, like, they're poop. There's two cats. So you got two things of poop. You want to sit in it? No. So if I'm doing an inventory, why would I just, oh, no, honey, we got to heal. We can't just be roaming around sick. Mm-mm. So, you know, I was given a time frame. I give my girls a time frame, 1 month, 1 month only. If it takes longer than a month, you have to work with someone else. I'm not sponsoring women to carry them. I'm sponsoring women who want to live differently. I'm very serious about it. I don't really care what anyone's opinion is. When I got sober, my sponsor took me through the book, and I take my girls through the book. I don't tell them what to underline, what to highlight. We go through it with a dictionary and a highlighter. They highlight what applies to them, and we exchange ideas about what it means so that they can develop a relationship. This book had to become three-dimensional in my life. I know the book, and I know the 12 and 12. Knowing it didn't keep me from acting like a crazy person. I had to develop a relationship. I had to bring it into my spirit. So in step four, I did a resentment, a fear, and a sex inventory. I got clear. I got down to the causes and conditions. And when I looked at all my fears, I had to ask myself in relation to every fear, where is God? If I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, why am I so fearful? Why do I not still believe that my God can meet all my needs? And when I got down to the sexual conduct, it was like vomiting. I remember Gloria gave me 2 weeks to do it. I did it in one night, because when I started writing, it was just filthy. I really couldn't handle it. And I just had to write it all the way. 17 and a half pages. Sick. Blah. You know what I mean? I was like, ooh, who's this? Who's doing that? What? You know what I mean? It says, where have I aroused jealousy, suspicion, bitterness, and doubt? Where have I not? That's who I am. Where have I been selfish and inconsiderate? That's who I am. I'm not thinking about your needs. I'm not trying to be a partner. I'm not trying to be a friend among friends. I'm trying to get mine. And that's what was revealed to me in this inventory. But then it asked me, what could I have done differently? Oh, there's a little light creeping in. That means I could do something differently when I'm presented with this situation next time. I love that. The book never just leaves you there. I mean, it'll give you some chunks of truth. You know what I mean? But it says, this is what we can do. This is what we can take. We can salvage this here. This, no, honey, let that go. But this here. And I shared it with my sponsor, and I remember my sponsor sharing back, and the freedom of that let me know that I wasn't by myself. My disease tells me I'm the only one that's ever done this ever. And you can't tell anyone ever, because they're going to make you leave AA. That's what my disease tells me. My sponsor is like, is that it? You know what I mean? That's all you got. And she shared back, and I was like, I can stay. And she said, you don't ever have to live this way again if you don't want to, but there are certain things you must do. This program is not unconditional. It is completely conditional. If I don't take action, I won't get the results. No action, no progress. And then in step six, I started looking at how these defects of character had manifested and caused these three inventories. What does pride look like in my life on a daily basis? What does lust look like? Because all these things are normal to have. It's when they far exceed their intended purpose that the problem starts. Everyone's going to have lust. I think you're cute. Doesn't mean I want to be with you. It just means I think you're cute. But here's the problem. When I think you're cute and you're with someone and I don't care, that's the problem. That's a defect of character. That's when I start feeling shame. That's when I start getting thirsty. You know, when I'm taking my girls through the steps, we stay in the big book until 6 and 7, and we go into 12 and 12. because it has to become three-dimensional. I want them to get clear on a daily basis, what does this look like? If this is what it looks like, I want you to take contrary action while you're asking God in step seven to remove what he finds objectionable. You know, I hear different things like, well, you know, my God hasn't removed that yet. It's like, that doesn't mean you just walk around stepping on toes. Once I find out what I'm doing, I'm now responsible. There's an accountability here. Alcoholics Anonymous made me accountable. And in step eight, when I started making the list of people I owed money, people I had harmed emotionally or physically because I was violent for a long time, you know, in step nine, when I started going to these people and looking them in the eye, I always describe it. I was talking to Tamara over lunch. You know, I was a spiritual infant. When I came to you, I was just so filled with shame. I was hurting, and it was like I was balled over. And as I start taking the steps, I literally start to sit up straight. When I got to step nine, I stepped into my shoes as a woman. I got true integrity in step nine. Step nine for me is not I apologize. That's not an amends. I apologize simply means, oops, bust it. I'll probably do it in another couple of weeks. Step nine means I come to you, I look you in the eye, and I cop to exactly what I have done. I am specific about the nature of my injuries to you. And then I ask you, have I omitted anything? Because I've done so much, I'm talking about these two, I've left out these five. I ask you, have I omitted anything? And then I ask you what I can do to make it right. I don't tell you what I'm going to do. How arrogant is that? I've like screwed over your life. Now I'm going to tell you, look, sweetie, I'm going to just do this right here. We need to be okay. That's crazy. I started getting some freedom when I was doing my ninth step. You know, I'll tell you, in step 10, I don't believe that people get drunk necessarily because they forget the pain of their last drink. I also believe people get drunk because the pain of living sober starts to outweigh the pain of their last drunk. If I am not in step 10 on a daily basis, there's just like a little thin film of dirt that starts to accumulate as a result of me living from self-will. A little thin film, but then it starts to just build up and it just suffocates my spiritual pores. And I start getting thirsty. So I have to get clear on a daily basis, what is my conduct? Have I done anything that means I need to go to you? And what have I done right? Because I also need to look at, you know what, this area seems to be improving. And in step 11, I learned to get quiet. Meditation and prayer for me, I love to pray because I love to talk, but meditating was like a little bit trickier. You know, how do I quiet myself and be okay sitting with self? When I went through that period of reconstructing my sobriety, the integrity of it, I really had to deepen my prayer meditation, especially because I suffer from depression and anxiety. I don't treat it with anything other than these steps for me and a lot of exercise. Oh, I put on Facebook this morning, gym or room service, right? And everyone started weighing in. They're like, room service. And they was like, no, go to the gym. No, room service. It was great. Anywho, little drama there, and I'll have to tell them I decided not to go to the gym. But, you know, in step 11, my meditation now looks like coloring books. When I went through that breakup, I was so devastated and, you know, all that madness I was doing. When I stopped and learned to sit still, I bought coloring books because I forgot how to dream. I was so devastated. I couldn't dream. I couldn't daydream. I couldn't do anything. And so I started off with the 64 box of crayons, and now I've graduated to the 96 box of crayons because I'm hardcore. You know what I mean? And so I color, and my older cat sits on her little perch and just looks down, and my younger cat helps me out. She'll kick a little crayon my way. I'm like, okay, this color. You know what I mean? And it just allows me to let God into my life. You know, or when I'm cooking and I'm chopping things, I'm meditating. I just lift my mind up to my Father. Or I like to walk, and I just acknowledge the beauty that my Father has created. And you call your God what you want. I'm not a religious person. I just have a relationship that's so awesome. It's so awesome. Really, it is. You know, and step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, the implication is that I've taken the preceding 11. We try to carry this message, the message outlined in the book. I think other books are great, but when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there has to be singleness of purpose. This book is what we're talking about, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all my affairs. That means that when I'm going through financial hardship, that I don't get to cut corners and I don't get to do things I used to do to make money. That means I either double up, get a second job, or do what I need to do. But I have to have principles in all my affairs because it's not as easy as it sounds. It's not as easy as it sounds, this deal. You know, and so what happened for me is I got sober and I just didn't know that I was going to be here 14 years later. I just had no idea. By the time I got sober, my daughter was almost 2 years old. I had her when I was 8 months pregnant. I named her Serenity because I thought that I wanted something opposite of what I had. I didn't know I was going to come into Alcoholics Anonymous because I was loaded when I had her. And I had been up for 3 days when I went into labor. And I remember holding her, and I remember her shaking. Every now and again, I would feel these slight tremors. And I told the doctor, and the doctor said, she's detoxing. And it broke my heart. When you want to be done and you're not, welcome to step one. When you want to be finished, when you know if you pick up this drink, this is what you stand to lose, and you pick it up anyway, welcome to step one. It is my understanding that you are not done until you are done. You cannot hear until you can hear, and you cannot see until you can see. There are many things in my sobriety I've wanted to be done with. That relationship, who would want to stay in a relationship where they're physically sick? I was throwing up every day. I was so sick in that relationship. I remember crying to Gloria, and she said, leave. I said, don't you think I would if I could? I wanted to be done, and I wasn't done until I was done. And holding her in that hospital, I still knew I wasn't done. And I loved her. If loving her was enough, I would have put the drink down. But without help, it is too much for me. And so I left that hospital. She was 3 days old, and I got busy coming to you. I got sober. She was almost 2 years old. I went through a recovery home. I told the director that I had a daughter because there were ladies there that had their children, and I thought maybe you could help me be a mom. Maybe I could bring my daughter here and you could help me. Maybe someone could help me. Maybe you could show me how to be tender, how to hold her, how to love her, how to not hit her. Maybe you could help me. And the director said, you have a daughter? No one knew because I didn't tell anyone. I hadn't seen her. I just started putting it out of my mind. But now I'm sober and I'm getting hope back. And I want to be a mom. And she said, Candace, get her. Bring her here. I said, I don't know where she is. And she said, okay. She gave me one number. It led to all these numbers. And at the end, they told me that my parental rights had been terminated. They told me that in the eyes of the law, I was no longer considered her parent, and I was devastated. I can do anything when I'm drinking. I do it all when I'm drinking. But when I get sober and I have to sit in my own skin and acknowledge what I've become, what I gave up to defend my right to drink, please give me a solution. It hurt so bad. I found out at 10 o'clock in the morning. I cried all that day. And the women there who found out what had happened would come up to me. I remember we were in a meeting that night. I don't know what the speaker looked like because I couldn't lift my head up. I just sat there and cried, and they would reach up and they would kiss me on the cheek and they would say, we love you, don't leave. But they didn't understand. I was done running. There was nowhere for me to go. My daughter is now 15 years old. I have not seen her since she was 3 days old. But here's the beauty. In 3 years, if she tries to find me, I need to be sober. A woman of dignity, a woman of self-respect, a woman of value, a woman of character. Last year, my daughter turned 14, but she's a year older than I am. That's how I know. And so I was, it was just heavy on my heart, heavy on my heart. And I called the director of the recovery home. I'm very active in H&I. We bring panels into recovery homes and jails. And I have a panel at this recovery home that I went through 14 years ago. I've always had it. And I called the director and I said, I'd like to give my daughter a birthday party and have it at the recovery home. And she goes, oh my God, you found your daughter. And I said, no, I haven't found my daughter. But I want to give her a party. Can I give her a party? And she goes, okay, you know what I mean? And so I said, just give me a head count of all the children so I know. So she called me back 2 days later. She said, there are 16 children. I said, I'll take it from there. We blocked off a day and a few hours. And so I had it all catered, all the food. I had cake and ice cream. I had gifts for all of the kids. And I asked the women I sponsor if they would be kind enough to come, those that are in state, if they would be kind enough to come and help me decorate. I said, it's not an AA commitment. You don't have to stay. and they all elected to stay and play with the kids. And, you know, we played Simon Says, we played the dance freeze game, and we played musical chairs. And, ooh, they're competitive with musical chairs. You're just like, honey, please, just take another gift. You know what I mean? Because if they don't get a chair, they'll fall out on the floor. Ah, that was my chair. You're like, oh, my God. And so, you know, but it was beautiful. And then we sang happy birthday to my daughter. We sang happy birthday to Serenity. And it was beautiful. And so what happened is that day, you know, because their moms came, there was food for their moms, but these little kids got gifts, they got all this stuff. Just for that day, I hope I made their parents' job just a little lighter, just for that day. And at the end, you know, we were all cleaning up, and this one little girl, you know how your parent would go say thank you, go say thank you, you know what I mean? So she comes over, she was cute, she came over, she tapped me. And I'm like, oh, hello. She goes, hello. She goes, I just want to say thank you. And I'm like, oh, did you have fun? Yeah. And then she had a little doll. I said, is that your little doll? Yeah. And then she said, I named her Serenity. How can I not acknowledge God? You've given that to me. My disease told me that I was worthless. My disease tells me you can't ever have a child, but I do want a child. And I believe that I will be a great mom. My disease wants to sell me short, and you just keep rallying for me. That's a spiritual experience. I made amends to my mother at 5.5 years sober. It was the amends I thought I would never make. I don't ever discuss what she's done, but I've done many things that were not appropriate as a daughter, and I had to make that right. I wrote her in prison. You know, and it was a lot of prayer that went into it before I talked to my sponsor. Because she had said a year before that, she said, you'll know when the time comes because it'll be all you can think about. And I said, the time will never come. See, it's one thing to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and start saying, let us love you until you can love yourself. You know, you just get so enlightened, you almost float away from the podium. It's very different to take these principles outside of the rooms to people that have hurt you the most. And so the time came, and I called her. I didn't call her. I wrote her, and she wrote me back, and she told me she was born again. No opinion. Many people who go to jail seem to be born again, but whatever. You know what I mean? And so, you know, so I wrote her. She wrote me, and at 10 years sober, my mother had written me saying that she had lung cancer, and it just broke my heart. I remember thinking that she was going to die behind prison walls, her body eaten from cancer, and it was just so sad. And I asked my sister, I'm the eldest of three, if she would go with me to see her in prison. It was the first time either of us had seen her in all the years she's been there, and, you know, it was just hard. A couple of things. She lied. She does not have any type of cancer, and she is not born again. And it was just very difficult. And my sister, who had suffered a lot of torture in addition to abuse, just kept crying, just sobbing. And I remember I wanted to fall apart, but I knew that my sister needed me. I also knew that when I got back to you, I would be able to do that. And it was important that I stand and I behave like a dignified, sober woman. And I was gracious to my mother. I was supportive of my sister. And a few days later, when I got, you know, we decided I would never go back, and nor would she, but I would continue to write her and send her what she needed. You know, Clancy walked me through all of that. From the minute the decision was made that I would go see her, he was just there. I mean, every step of the way. And, you know, I knew that it was going to come. I knew the break was going to happen. I didn't know when. And I left my home group one night. It was maybe a few days after I'd seen my mother. And at that time, I lived 35 miles each way from my home group. And I was driving. It was almost 10:30 at night. I was on the freeway, and it came. And I couldn't drive. I couldn't see. I couldn't think. It was too much for me. I just couldn't. It was too much. The pain was too much. Everything was too much. And I pulled over, and I was sobbing. And my sponsor's on speed dial, and I hit one button, and he got on that phone. It was almost 11 o'clock at night. And I said, I can't handle this. I can't take it. I can't do it. And he said, I understand. He always says that. He goes, I understand. He says, I know right now you're overwhelmed. It's okay. I said, I can't drive. I can't see. He said, this is what I want you to do. He gave me step-by-step instructions, turn the car on, signal, merge into traffic. He had to do it. And he said, when you get home, I want you to get on your knees, and I want you to go to your God, and then I want you to sleep, and in the morning it's going to look different. And he hung up, and I'll tell you, that's what I said. My, you know, the head, they were talking. Woo, they were really just going. And I said, Clancy said... You know what I mean? And they would say something like, no, Clancy said, And he said, merge into traffic. You know what I mean? And I was just driving, and I would just say, nope, Clancy said. And then I was like, Clancy said, park my car and get on my knees. Go on my, you know, and so that's what I did. And it was hard. This deal is not easy, but there is freedom. Because here's the thing. When I stay sober, I break the cycle of insanity in my family. And then I work with another woman, and she starts to heal, and she breaks the cycle of insanity in her family. And then she works with one of her girls. We are doing phenomenal things here in Alcoholics Anonymous. This deal is good. I just want to thank you for hanging out with me this afternoon. I look forward to hanging out with you this weekend. My sober sister Sharon is talking tomorrow morning at 10, and I just love and adore her, and so I'm just thrilled to hear her and the rest of everyone else. You know, I just want to share this with you. If you want what we have, I can only recommend that you do what we do. Thank you.